Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hello, monkeys!
I affected a weird British accent for that one, sort of. I wonder, is that offensive? I don't even know anymore. Hey, everybody. Larry Morgan here. Back in the monkey cage with a second appearance by the great director Paul Feig. Freaks and Geeks he created. He also directed Bridesmaids and Spy and The Heat. And he was actually with us in the summer of 2016, just before the release of his big blockbuster reboot of Ghostbusters, with the all-female lead cast, which, as it turns out, did not either kill anyone or completely erase the original 1984 version, either from the memory of the people who enjoyed it the first time, or physically the prints didn't dissolve into dust when the new one came out. Turns out, you can enjoy the original with Dan Aykroyd, Bill Murray, and Rick Moranis, and Harold Ramis. And you can enjoy this new one for a whole new generation of people. Paul is back with a brand new movie that opens this Friday as of this release called A Simple Favor. It is a bit of a departure for him, as he's done mostly comedic stuff. This is a thriller starring Anna Kendrick and Blake Lively, and it's getting some good buzz on it. Looks very sleek and elegant and interesting. There are comic elements to it. He explains all that. So enjoy, won't you? This episode of Snark Monkey with director Paul Feig is brought to you by nobody, because I don't have a sponsor yet. Somebody pony up some dough and bet on this donkey. What? Am I mixing? But it just hit the thing. You have been embracing the social media a little bit more lately, it seems.
Well, you? I've always been a Twitter guy, but Twitter's become so much less fun for various reasons over the last few years.
I've been following your globe-trotting Machu Picchu recently.
Yeah, we've just spent a little over a week in Peru. And yeah, Instagram, I've now... I'm trying to be more active on Instagram because it's more fun and everybody's nicer on Instagram, I find.
Yeah, there's less incentive to just be nasty and mean.
Yeah.
I mean, who's going to pick on you for taking a hike and going up to the top of Machu Picchu?
See, exactly. Yeah. Maybe some ancient Incas from... They're from the past. They're like, hey, get out of our place.
They're so cranky.
I know.
I think the most interesting thing about that trip you took to Peru, as I followed it, was that I finally got to see you in something resembling casual clothing.
They must be erased from the internet immediately.
You wore a cap. You wore a baseball-style cap hat.
Yes, exactly. It was one of those trips where we were moving around so much that I realized I couldn't bring tons of suitcases and hat boxes, if you will, like some sort of a traveler from 100 years ago.
But I don't know what made me feel so at ease to know that Paul actually does. I think I maybe have asked you about this before, but do you have like evening clothes? Do you wear do you have the satin pajamas at night, the smoking jacket around the
I
house?
Do have all that, yeah. Sometimes I put
them?
It on. Sometimes I do. It depends what mood I'm in. Other times I'll just put on a flannel shirt and a pair of jeans that nobody ever sees just because I'm going to sit and watch TV on my sorry ass.
You're probably sick of talking about your sartorial splendor.
I enjoy it.
But at what point did you make a concentrated effort that you were going to dress as nattily as you do?
Well, I mean, it kind of started when I was a kid. because I'd read a book about a biography about Groucho, who said he didn't trust any man or didn't dress up.
Mm-hmm.
So I started then and dipped my toe in and had a bought, you know, my mom bought me a suit that was really fancy that I outgrew eventually. But I tried
there
to
is
hang
a spectacular
on.
Outfit on the cover of one of your books.
Yes, on the front of Super Stud. That was for a dance recital, but that was my suit. It was a suit I had because I was a big Steve Martin fan, so I had this 3-piece Steve Martin suit back when he used to do that.
Yeah.
And then I morphed it for the recital by putting on a spicy bow tie and a ruffled shirt. So yeah. That was gorgeous. But I don't think I kind of went back and forth on dressing up, but it wasn't until right after I did Freaks and Geeks and was in a meeting, you know, a lot of people thought they wanted to develop a new show with me, and they soon realized they didn't. But, you know, and I was still kind of in my jeans and T-shirt mode. And I remember just sitting in those meetings, and they always put you on, the lowest couch in the place, and you're sitting there with, your knees in your face, and everybody else is in suits and ties and dressed nice, and they're sort of dictating their criticism of what you want to do and are pitching. And I just was like, I don't like this dynamic at all. I feel so identifiable as the quote-unquote artist.
Right.
You know, and so when I was looking around them and go, I used to wear suits. Now I'm in my mid-30s. Maybe I'll just start again because I kind of miss it. And so I went out and bought a bunch of suits and started wearing them to the meetings. And then, unbeknownst to me, the industry decided at that very moment to change and become much more casual because they got tired of being called the suits. And so I showed up. I think it had to be my next meeting, all in my suit and tie. Here I am. I'm going in. I'm going to be one of them. And everyone's in jeans and T-shirts.
Yeah, studio heads are totally. Suddenly just the super casual guys.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's all, you know, and so... But as Hollywood will annoyingly do, it wasn't maybe we should have dressed up. They immediately shift the dynamic of dummy here doesn't get that that's not cool anymore. So clearly he went and put on his Sunday go-to-meeting clothes and, you know, dressed up. And there was a derisive feeling in the room. But I remember just going, I'm not going to buy into this because I actually think I look good. And I actually don't think I looked good before. When I was wearing jeans and T-shirts, and now I think you guys look underdressed, and so I just never stopped and just kept stepping it up as I went along.
That is an interesting thing, especially about out here, because I do anytime I do work with other clients from other parts of the country, it is very much a West Coast and especially a Los Angeles thing at a high level of business to be super casual. I still when I talk to. You know, I do commercials for clients in Texas or whatever, and the CEOs are, they're still buttoned up in their suits, and they're not always fitting that great,
right.
And they might be right off the rack from some random place, but they do feel the need to present a certain kind of look in
it's
business.
I think it's a uniform. I always say, you know, if you're in charge, you're the captain of the ship, and if I got on a ship and the captain was wearing shorts and, you know, T-shirt, I'd probably get off the ship.
It's funny you say the thing about the artist, because I think there is a point at which you kind of I don't want to wear a uniform, man. I'm just going to be the rebellious type, but in a way that it's its own uniform of slouchy, I don't give a shittedness.
To me, that's the most kind of, you know, blending in thing you can do is to just kind of dress like a slob in those things, because you're not making any, I don't think you're making any kind of statement, or I think you're making an old-fashioned statement.
Right.
It's like, hey, I'm not a suit. And it's like, you know what? Nobody even thinks of you. They're still going to call you the suits. You can show up in Hawaiian shorts, and they're still going to go, okay, that's the guy who's in charge, or that's the woman who's in charge, and they're just going to come and try to ruin our project. So you're not fooling anyone is what I'm saying. So you might as well look good.
I like the thing about it for you that I like, and I've kind of thought about this way too much, clearly, because we spent, 20 minutes talking about it, is that as a human being, you are a supremely goofy person.
Yes.
At heart and otherwise.
True.
And so the fact that you are so... just classy in every other respect is in itself this kind of interesting statement of here's this very silly man who looks fantastic. And I think that throws people off a little bit, but in a way it's both approachable. You are an approachable person. You're not a scary, you know, mean person.
Yeah.
But you also look like you've got your act together.
Yeah, it's kind of false legitimization, I guess, really.
No, it's not false.
Well, you know what it is? I mean, honestly, I think, I love that, that talk show hosts have always worn suits and ties. And I remember, like, Craig Ferguson, for after a while, like, stopped wearing a tie and dressed more casual. And I was like, there's something about a funny person dressed nice. It throws it off. I like to also say, you know, if you're a Monty Python fan, the Ministry of Silly Walks would have not been half as funny if John Cleese was, you know, wearing jeans and, like, you know, a button-up shirt. Like,
right,
it would not be funny. It's the fact that he is dressed like a banker, like, very staid that way. And I, so I like that. I like sort of the, you know, adults being silly. And so, you know, if you dress like an adult, you know, and then dressing, there's a thing in men's fashion called sprezzatura, which means that something should be out of place or something should let people know you're not that serious about it. And so whether it's, you know, I don't know, your tie's not tied right, or you have pocket silk that's kind of popping out, or just whatever it is, like that's kind of a way to signal I'm not serious. And I feel like I am the sprezzatura, because clearly I'm not that serious of a person. So the nicer I dress, the more people are like, all right, like, I don't know if they, you know, I think they get it. And if they don't, then I'd like to think I look good.
Well, you have inspired me, and I'm not kidding about this. I have, not that I aspire to anywhere near the level of what you've got in your closet, but I did go, and as a podcast lover and listener myself,
yes,
I bought into Stitch Fix. And so, in fact, I'm wearing, in your honor, this very lovely polo shirt.
I think you look lovely.
This is nice. This is about as far as I'll go.
But it's, you know, I'm telling you, a collar on a man makes all the difference in the world, whether it's a collar on a fancy shirt, or whether it's on a polo shirt or whatever. And I have very sloping shoulders. So I've noticed, like, when I would just be wearing, like, a T-shirt, I look terrible. I mean, terrible.
Yep, I'm right there with you.
Yeah.
I think we have a similar body type. For better or worse.
We're big and strong.
Yeah, that's right.
Broad-shouldered.
Yeah, that's right. Strapping young men.
Yes, that's right.
All right. Well, this has been Fashion Talk with Paul Feig.
Mm-hmm. Join us next week, and we'll talk about socks.
I'm surprised you haven't been. Have you ever been dragged onto any, like, fashion police type show to talk about that?
No.
Would you do that?
I would. I would in a heartbeat. Yeah, when Joan was still alive, Joan Rivers, she wanted to have me on the Fashion Police, but they were going through that thing with the non-union, and so I didn't cross the picket line.
Right.
But I was so excited to, like, I was hoping they were going to, like, solve it, and then I could come on, and then sadly she passed. But
because you can talk the talk. I mean, you really know brands
enough.
And style and history and that sort of thing. It's become a thing.
I mean, the only thing I don't like is being judgmental against people, but I think it'd be fun to just sort of, in a positive way, sort of talk about what people are wearing.
Right.
But I think the only sin people commit is if they don't try, or if they just don't have a style.
Mm-hmm.
And a style can be you wear funny T-shirts all the, and that's your style. But at least it says who you are. And I'm always just against, like, dressing so you don't get arrested. You know, like, all right, he's not naked, so we can't take him in. But
yes, that's actually the criteria for most people in radio, I can tell you.
Oh, trust me. Well, but it's stuff like that where, you know, when I was a kid, you know, I had all my favorite DJs that I thought, you know, and I just had this image of them.
What was your image?
I thought they would look like a 50s DJ. You know, like when you see Grease, you know.
Right,
like,
right. They're wearing the suit and tie.
Yeah, the suit and tie, flashy.
Nobody sees this movie, but American Hot Wax Freed.
No, and that's exactly.
Yeah, he's wearing a suit while he's on the air, and all the engineers are wearing suits while they're.
See?
Yeah.
So that's my image of it. And so I remember once, and I had all, CKLW was my favorite. It was this AM radio station. And I just had such an image of what they all looked like. And then they put out this ad. It was all of the DJs. They were under, like, the call letters, and they were, like, standing, like, you know, with their, like, starfish, like, they were kind of arms up to the heavens, and they looked awful. Yeah. And they were all, like, their hair was all over the place, and they were wearing
scruffy,
crappy T-shirts. And one guy was wearing shorts, and I was just like, oh no. It was such an affront to my image. But I was also the kid that thought when songs played on the radio that the bands were actually in the radio station. I remember thinking, like, how does our local radio station have the Beatles there all the time? So that's how dumb I was.
Kids are dumb. Yeah, I mean, we were all stupid. No, radio people are filthy, dirty animals, so it's always a shock when you can get us to actually. I do remember going in when I was working in Sacramento, and they had just moved the radio station from outside of town. Usually, you know, it's either in an office building right in a, you know, kind of a normal business area,
yeah.
or you're stuck way out in the middle of nowhere, the city of license, as
yeah.
it were,
yeah.
and we were above a bank building, and then they moved us into an office building where there were some local regional headquarters, and I came in one day, and I was casually dressed. I was going on the air. I didn't care what I looked like then, somebody who was going up to, I think, a Morgan Stanley office in the building literally said to me, "So, where do you work?" I was like, FM 102. I was like, "Oh, no dress code there?" And I was so stunned into silence by the time he got off the elevator. I didn't think, I mean, eventually I thought of the comeback of, no, yes, they make us wear clothes there. And that would have been my snappy retort.
Say, oh, if only we could turn back time.
Let us transition. I had a really just like smooth radio style transition, but I'm hungry and tired. So I'm just going to go right to a simple favor.
Perfect.
Just shifting gears immediately.
Look at you.
I think there was something about, oh, I know what it was. It was that the trailer looks very classy. It looks just kind of like this very elegant. And they are even touting this as a departure from the comedic mind of Paul Feig or whatever.
The darker side of Paul Feig.
Yeah, there we go.
Which I think it makes me laugh. It does make me laugh.
But it's true. I mean, and this, for anybody who's seen the trailer, and we're releasing this just before the film opens, it is very much something different than we would expect, unless it's just a big prank and there's going to be people pooping in sinks.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly. You phoned me up. That's
oh,
a simple
I?
Favor. No. No, I mean, it's a thriller, first and foremost.
Yeah, yeah.
I love the thriller genre. But everything I do has to have some element of humor to it or quirkiness. Because I love the old Hitchcock movies, you know, and the Hitchcock movies, they're very tense and they're very suspenseful, but there's funny moments
sure.
in them, you know,
yeah.
especially with a lot of his supporting cast, like real oddball eccentric types will show up, or, you know, when you got Cary Grant doing his thing, I just think, for me, look, and I love all the modern thrillers, and I watch them all the time, but for me, I go like, I want to do that, but I don't want to be so serious that we're not having fun,
right.
you know. Thrillers are inherently sort of ridiculous, you know, because they, especially if they get really twisty and turny, they can
right.
be quite silly.
In terms of logic, if you're really kind of
yeah.
paying too close attention and not just going with the flow of the film,
well, people are doing.
Wait a minute,
yeah, people are doing really extreme things,
yeah.
you know, and it's emotions are heightened and all that, so. But I never wanted. It's never a spoof. I get so insulted when a reviewer or an article refer to one of my movies as a spoof. Like with Spy, they call, you know, the James Bond spoof Spy. It's like Spy's not a spoof. I mean, maybe if you watch that and you think it, then I failed. But I say that I want to make like a real spy movie.
Yeah.
But then I'm going to put really eccentric, quirky characters in it, and their interactions are going to be funny in the way that if you had a bunch of crazy people in a very serious situation, something funny would come out
right.
of it.
Right. And Spoof says to me that you would be sending up the genre a la Airplane or Naked Gun with jokes and sight gags, and that's not what, clearly not what Spy was.
Yeah.
It was a really good spy story that happened to be really funny.
Thanks.
That's what you were shooting for, I assume.
Yeah. Oh, no, 100%. No, honestly, before this movie, that was my favorite one that I did, but I really think this new one, Simple Favor, is my favorite because, you know, every time I do a movie, I try to walk this tonal tightrope between the real movie, the real genre that we're doing, and playing it for real. But then how do I still find funny in it in a way that doesn't subvert the reality?
Right, right.
And this one was this was even more of a tightrope than Spy was, and Spy was a real tightrope.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Because, I mean, you do have, as your leads, we've got Anna Kendrick and mm-hmm. Blake Lively.
Yep.
Nice going, by the way.
Thanks. You know, they're not bad. They're not bad, though. So they got a future in this business.
Yeah, I think they got some promise. both of them do have the chops, clearly, to be funny and to push that envelope with you.
Yeah.
I can see where that would be, especially for something that is meant to be outright a thriller. I mean, the trailer clearly sets up something very mysterious, cliffhanger-y, you know, what happened to so-and-so, that sort of thing, which is just kind of a classic basic right there, a setup for something.
It's a great genre. Yeah, I mean, it's a great genre to play with in that way.
Were you pushing for this? Were you looking for something like this? Did this fall in your lap?
Well, both. I'd been wanting to do a thriller. I kept saying, like, you know, if you look at all my movies are genre movies. That's all they are. I just love genres. And
people lump you in the comedy side of it because they happen to be funny people in funny movies.
Right. But no, I honestly think I'm a genre filmmaker. I mean, my hero of all time, it's a filmmaker, is Howard Hawks.
I was going to say the same thing.
Yeah, you know, I mean,
this is who we grew up.
Yes.
Yeah, this is who we grew up learning about when you and I were both movie geeks.
Yep.
And once you started to kind of see the connection, once we understood who directors were and what they did.
Totally.
And Hawks, for me, the same. Billy Wilder is kind of in that same thing, where, you know, some of the best comedies of all time. Oh, they also have, Hawks did one of the best westerns of all time.
Yeah.
I like Red River better than any other thing that John Ford made.
I could do
a screwball comedy, and they could turn around and do Billy Wilder's The Lost Weekend and Sunset Boulevard and Some Like It Hot. That just doesn't seem fair.
Yeah, totally.
But those are that's probably when we were little wannabe movie makers, when you were making Super 8 crap in the middle of your alleys and backyard.
Exactly, downtown L.A.
You wanted to do everything.
Well, I kind of figured that out slowly. It was just because I always wanted to do comedy, but I found that, you know, unless it was like Marx Brothers, those things were just like, they're just balls out. They only exist to make you laugh. They're crazy. They're anarchistic and all that. All the other comedies I would watch always felt like the wheels were off the track. I mean, look, there's classics like Animal House and Blues Brothers, I think, is a perfect movie, personally, just because it's...
You think it's Blues Brothers is a perfect movie?
I do. I honestly do.
Okay, we're going to come back to that. You can finish your thought, but I'm making a mental note here. We're
make
putting a pin
note
in that.
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
But, you know, but I found that, like, there was... A lot of people use, unless they were doing just total anarchy like the Marx Brothers, they use the comedy genre as a way to go, oh, well, we have a story, but we don't necessarily have to be that realistic in our portrayal of the story. And, oh, we can do a joke at the expense of the character and of the rules that we've set up, you know. And so you're kind of going along like, oh, okay, this is fun, but I know the stakes here and I know what I'm invested in. And then suddenly, like, a joke or a set piece will come up. And you go like, wait, why is that person who I thought I knew what they were about doing something in a way that I don't believe what they're doing?
Yeah,
it's fun to surprise it on and go like, oh my God, I didn't think that person would do that. But you should always go like, but I see that they would do that. But when they just do something, you're like, why the hell did they do that?
Right.
That clearly they're just trying to go for a joke, the filmmaker. Then it threw it all off. And so for me, I just was like, I need to face my comedies like they're dramas that are funny.
Interesting. And actually, we talked about this before, but your first major motion picture was not filled with laughs at all.
No, it was not. I Am David, the little scene. I think it's still on Netflix.
I remember you and I had an email exchange where... you were very kind. We were trying to figure out a time where I could come and just visit the office that you were directing episodes at the time.
Yeah.
And you just happened to, you were kind of quietly touting, oh, I Am David's on HBO right now. And it was like, it was kind of this very gentle plea to me to, like, could somebody please watch it? There's some good stuff in it.
You know?
And I thought it was lovely. It was like you seemed very proud of it as much as, you know, you were a little hamstrung by budget and that sort of thing.
Well, you're proud of all your children, you know, even the ugly ones. And, you know, I was...
Oh, I hate my ugly kids.
No, that's the one.
Oh.
That one, that one's got to come. I mean, look, you work so hard on these movies.
Right.
I mean, before that, I made a movie for $30,000 that never got released because I paid for it out of pocket.
Yeah.
I shot it in 6 days as a feature film in the middle of a field. It's an hour and a half long, and I'm really proud of it. But I worked as hard on that movie as I do on, you know, Ghostbusters. And so to put all that time and energy and sweat and everything into it and then nobody sees it is just gutting, you know, because that's why we make movies. I'm not like a painter who paints a painting and then burns it because I don't want anybody to see it.
Right.
I want people to see it. And so, you know, I Am David just didn't. It didn't draw you into the theater because it was a I didn't understand kind of how to do commercial film back then, and so you just kind of go like, I love this, who wouldn't love this? And then you make it, and you don't go like, okay, if I didn't know me and I didn't know how good I could make this, quote unquote, if I was just like going watching a trailer, would I say I got to see that?
Yeah.
And it's a pretty good litmus test if you are really honest about it, because you can go, God, I don't want to see that. You know, this I Am David was a movie about a kid who grows up in a communist labor camp and he's beaten and then he escapes. And, you know, and it's like who wants to see?
Yeah, that? give me your wacky elevator pitch on that one there, Fee.
Oh, I
Let's
know.
Hear it.
And it was a very uplifting story and lovely, and I tried to infuse as much humor into it as I could, but
it was something you were passionate about, and that's kind of what you go on. You know, there is a point in our lives, I remember, I was just having this conversation with somebody, because there are certain mid-80s movies that people have this huge affection for, and I'm thinking specifically like some of the John Hughes stuff, mm-hmm. Goonies, for instance.
Yeah.
And normally, I would love that kind of. You and I, I should say, we are exactly the same age. Mm-hmm. If you were to look at this,
we're both 35.
Yeah, that's right. We're both in our mid 30s, so we weren't even around in the 80s.
It's weird, but we're very quick
yeah,
learners.
That's right. But we caught up on all that stuff. But because I was in film school at the time, I suddenly went from just kind of consuming every great fun movie I could think of and being a kid and loving all that stuff, mm-hmm. I suddenly rejected all the mainstream stuff because I was suddenly really into like the artistic stuff.
Yes,
of course. I was digging into everything Scorsese did, and I was learning about Antonioni and you know, the Italian film and Fellini, and I was going to all these other film classes, and I suddenly was rejecting real mainstream popcorn stuff to the point that I don't have much of an affection for that stuff anymore. Mm-hmm. Or any kind of, I don't have a connection to it because it wasn't part of my life then.
Yeah.
And I wonder if there's a point in our lives where, you know, if we're trying to be artists, and clearly you carried it further than I was able to, but there's a point at which you just have to stop taking yourself so seriously and also realize where your strength is and where your passion and that strength connects.
Yeah.
I mean, was there kind of a moment or a time in your life where you were like connecting those dots?
I mean, it kind of came and went. The problem is everyone's quest, I think it's a quest for awards, quite
really?
Frankly. I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, well, what?
Not a conscious thing, but like.
No, but you go like, what's the thing that's going to like impress everybody? And, you know, but we get that in film school because, I came in totally, and I never quite lost it. I was made fun of in so many of my classes because I kept
because you liked
cartoons and I was like the one defending E.T. and all I ever heard everybody's like it is so manipulative. It was so it's a movie. Every movie is manipulative. I'm taking the back of your head and going look at this. Yeah.
I am
manipulating
yes.
you. You know, and so I just kind of always. I think part of why I didn't lose it is because I felt so much pressure from everyone around me that I wasn't supposed to like that kind of thing.
Yeah,
that I always kind of held on to it. But I think it comes from the fact that I was a stand-up comedian for so long. I just want to entertain an audience. And you know, when I made I Am David, that was sort of my attempt to kind of be a little more serious. And I remember, wrote I found the book, or the book was brought to me, and then I wrote the script to my agent going like, wow, like this is like award-winning kind of things. And I go, oh my gosh, maybe I'm going to win an award. And it just, I realized how derailed I got from that. Not that I faced the movie like I was, it was an art film, but it was like I wasn't thinking commercially. I wasn't thinking, is this going to entertain an audience? And I like to think it does if they're in the right mood for
that. Sure, sure.
But I don't want to be the guy that sort of, craps on people for liking something silly. Look, there's plenty of stuff I don't like that I go like, why do people like that? But I never want to say that and like call anything out publicly. First of all, I have a hatred of when any artist calls out another artist. I just think it's not, that's not what we do. We should either don't say anything or give them praise if they do something you like, but like don't crap on other people's, because we went through it, how hard it is to get something made.
Right
and nobody makes a movie that they because they think it's going to be bad unless they're
not going
for fun.
You're not going out of your way to make something shitty, and you're usually putting a whole lot of yourself into it, and inevitably, you're going to no matter what, somebody's going to criticize something, but just to kind of tear it down and not respect the fact that somebody really put a lot of themselves into
totally.
It.
Totally. And also on the flip side of that, there's going to be people that like it. I mean, honestly, well, I use this example all the time. You bring up Goonies. Do you remember, did you go with my class when we went to visit the set of Goonies?
No.
Yeah, we got to go and into the big, you know, the set with the pirate ship
and everything.
Yeah, totally. And we went in, they took us in, and I forget who the production designer or whoever it was that was kind of lecturing our class that day said, they made it and they're not going to let the cast see it until they walk in. And so they're going to have this natural reaction. And I just thought that was really cool. But then the reason I bring it up is when that movie came out, it got terrible reviews. It got like kind of killed in the review, and now it's one of the most beloved movies of all time.
Right.
And so, honestly, when I've gone through things like that, when I went with Ghostbusters, you go, okay, look. Ironically, we got good reviews for the most part on that movie, but going like, time's just going to sort this out. Everybody's got all these political reasons why they're mad about it, and there's all this maelstrom. But you go, look, 20 years from now, 10 years from now, 5 years from now, even, it's just a movie, and either people go like, oh, I like that movie, it's really funny, or they don't. And you almost have to kind of keep your eye on the prize that way and go like, what's going to entertain people? I just want to make a movie that you watch a bunch of times.
Yeah. By the way, congratulations on being able to recover from destroying all our childhoods.
You've done
a nice job of coming back.
I feed off of that. It's like drinking the blood of your enemies. Exactly. Right. Yeah. So I actually lost 20 years. I got younger.
I was going to say, all the lines are gone.
Exactly. My hair's all blonde again. Yeah.
I got to get a deal like that. Okay. Let's get back to
Blues Brothers.
Which is interesting because this is not exactly that. Because, again, same thing. I mean, there was a certain type of movie that started coming out when we were that age where those guys were just like, had all the toys and all the tools. And when you're talking Aykroyd and Belushi, who were just gods of comedy at that time for us, and SNL was like such a seminal thing.
Yeah.
I mean, look, I'm in the same boat. I must have seen Blues Brothers 3 times. Mm-hmm. I saw Spielberg's 1941 3 times.
That movie. I thought that was the greatest movie. And then I found out it was a big disaster.
Yeah.
And he hated it. I thought it was hilarious.
I had a blast. At that, I bought the book. Remember the books they would put out about the making of those?
Totally.
Like, we were such nerds.
I had a Wild Bill poster on my wall. It was John Belushi in the thing that said, Wild Bill wants you. I had that up in my room.
Yeah. There are some great little things in that movie. Yeah. But, honestly, Blues Brothers for me doesn't really stand the test of time that great. People refer to it as bloated. And that was kind of the joy of it, is that Landis was basically like, was running wild with every dollar is on the screen. I don't know how many extras. They had the entire city of Chicago in that movie. It was ridiculous.
It's absolutely joyous. And that's all. Here's my thing. I don't like mean-spirited stuff. And honestly, if you talk about the 80s got very mean-spirited. I mean, even if you look at, and I love these movies like 48 Hours, Beverly Hills Cops, but there's a mean-spiritedness to those movies, especially towards women. I mean, my God, the portrayals of women are horrible.
Yeah, they're a little tough to watch now.
Yeah, but so when I watched, Blues Brothers, it was just so much fun because it was so like willfully goofy, and it set up right from the top, it's going to be goofy, and it never broke that tone. The tone stayed completely, the same. And, there's Carrie Fisher showing up, she's blowing up a thing, and then they're trapped under it, and they just kind of come out from under a bunch of bricks, and you go like, oh, this is the world. But he never breaks that.
Yeah.
So by the time you get to that amazing car chase at the end where they literally destroy about 100 cop cars, which is so great. But then, turn the coin and you go to Blues Brothers 2000, I think they wrecked 1,000, and then you go like, it was funny because it was so much. Now this is just dumb. So, but I just think with all the music and it's joyous, you got a great Aretha Franklin performance in there, and James Brown in the church, and it's dancing and fun and...
Yeah, that movie seemed to exist in its own universe, and maybe that was part of the fun of it, is that because for us, the Blues Brothers were basically just a musical act on SNL.
That
they didn't have a persona because it was this very... They were enigmas.
Yeah.
And so to actually see it come to life and be this very kind of alternate universe style of something going on. Yeah. And it was, but like I say, for me, it was also just like all these great faces showing up and all this incredible music and the color of it, that James Brown, you know, church sequence is just like people are doing backflips in the air, clearly off of trampolines we don't see off, you know, off camera. And it's just like, what world are we in that this exists?
Totally. But,
and
but,
I wanted to be there.
Totally. Yeah. And he sets it. I mean, you know, the fact, you know, Henry Gibson's car drives off like a ramp, and then suddenly it's literally they've dropped it from a helicopter, you know, a mile above the city. And you go like, I got to tip my hat. Like, that is unabashedly saying, we're just going to be nuts, and you're just going to go along for the ride.
Are there other movies like that that you've been thinking about lately that have kind of conjured up memories of that kind of pure joy, or just those things? Not just not favorite movies, but ones like that where the experience was just unlike you had experienced.
Yeah, I mean, this kind of goes in, it's part and parcel with sort of what is comedy and what isn't. When I saw Star Wars, like pretty much opening weekend, every minute of that movie, there was an enormous laugh, a giant laugh. And I will go to my grave saying Star Wars is a comedy. It's an action comedy. Because, you know, like, take it seriously. You know, everything is serious. The stakes couldn't be higher. You know, they're trying to save the world or whatever, you know, try to save the resistance and stop this evil empire, which is very, you know, a big World War II. You know, like, it's just, you know, it's everything the bad in the world. But they did it with these really fun characters, and there's just, Lucas had jokes along the way. And I remember the audience going crazy. Every minute, a giant laugh. And then same thing with Raiders of the Lost Ark. Same type of
absolutely.
Thing. Those are action comedies, but what's great is they don't present themselves as comedies, they're not sold as comedies, you go, oh, this is an action film, and I'm having so much fun. So that's what I want to do. I mean, I feel like some of my movies have been hurt in the marketing because they've just gone like, it's a comedy. Like Spy got hurt by the fact that they were just like, it's a crazy comedy.
Yeah.
Because it is a comedy, but it's a real spy movie. And so what happened, they would do ads where you always see her falling over on the scooter.
Yeah, we talked about the scooter, yeah.
Yeah, and in the context of the movie, it makes sense, but you know, in an ad, it just looks silly. Yeah. So, you know, that's why with Simple Favor, you know, we are a thriller, but you're going to have fun, and you will laugh in it. But if I said it was a comedy, it's not funny enough to be sold as a comedy.
Right.
And I didn't want it to be that.
Yeah, there's probably some algorithm somebody could come up with, you know, laughs per minute or something where suddenly it's like, nope, you didn't meet the comedy threshold, Paul. We're gonna have to call this a thriller instead.
Well, I wish they would do that at the Golden Globes, I'll tell you that much.
No kidding.
You know, they jam these movies into the comedy section.
The Martian, right? That's the most egregious.
Yeah, Spy and Trainwreck lost to The Martian, which The Martian's an amazing movie.
Yeah.
But it's got like a couple of laughs in it. It's not, I wouldn't call it a comedy.
Clearly not a comedy.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny, just going on that same premise, I think we think the same way, but I think it's also the movies that stand the test of time are because they are able to satisfy all those little joy centers in the brain. Whether I immediately thought of Die Hard.
Yeah.
Moments that Will is, you know, come out to the coast. We'll have a few. Yeah. I mean, he's, you know, it's the middle of this really intense action movie. Jaws, in particular, I think has Spielberg's always been very good about peppering, you know, funny moments. There are light, and clearly part of that is just to diffuse the tension. If you were just tension the whole time, then when there is really something to feel, you know, good horror movies use that very effectively in much the same way.
Yeah, and I just feel like a lot of movies, you know, when they're dramas or, you know, thrillers or whatever, have lost that just the kind of ethos to do that, to realize the audience needs that and the audience wants that.
Yeah.
Everything, that's why I just, everything's so compartmentalized. It's like, are you a drama or are you a comedy? You know, and it's like, well, what if we're like life and we're laughing and it's tense at the same time?
Tell us more about A Simple Favor. This is based on a novel, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that's all I know.
There you go.
I know the plot from the trailer.
There you go. Well, you think you might know. Exactly. Do you really know?
Oh, well, I think I do, Mr. Feig. I think I figured it all out. In fact, I know where she is and who did it.
Oh, no. Oh, great.
It's pretty
spoiler
obvious,
alert.
Frankly.
Yeah, it's all right. It's written all over the screen. No, it was, the road was it was a book that it had a big bidding war in Hollywood for it. And this was before we got involved at all. And Fox 2000 got it. They hired Jessica Sharzer, this amazing writer, to do the adaptation. And then they sent it to us, because we have a producing deal, my company, FICO Entertainment, with them. And so they sent it to us saying, like, this movie's, like, crazy. It's like, it's a thriller, but it's sort of bananas. Like, we don't know if it's a comedy, is it a drama? And so they sent it over to us, and I read it and loved it so much. I was like, I want to direct this, because I'd been wanting to do a thriller, but I don't know how to write a thriller, really, from scratch. And so just kind of jumped on it, and and then worked with Jessica Sharzer, just going like, hey, let's even make it even more twisty. Let's even have more fun and with the surprises, and just plowed forward. And ironically, like 9 weeks out, Fox decided they actually didn't want to do it anymore.
Oh.
So the fantastic Lionsgate came sweeping in and saved us right at 9 weeks out for production, and we kept us right on schedule. So
it's interesting for you to say, or just even being self-aware, I guess, enough to say, I don't know how to write a thriller. I mean, you write a lot, you have written a lot. Why does that feel like something you couldn't crack, or are you just, it just hasn't, not your brain doesn't work that way?
Yeah, I don't think my brain works that way. I read a lot of thrillers. Patricia Highsmith's like my favorite author, I think, of all time, actually. So I around it now, he's going like, oh, I can write that, but like when I sit down to do it, it's like, it's hard. I'm better off if like somebody supplies the bones or gives, mm-hmm. And then it's like, oh, then I can see how I can add to that. It's just, yeah, it's just a different skill set, really.
Yeah. And as far as casting the film, we mentioned the two lovely leads, mm-hmm. that you've got there. Or have you worked with Blake before?
No, I've never worked with Anna or Blake.
Okay.
I'm just a giant fan of both of them. And, with Anna, it was like, I'd seen her, like when she's in 50-50, I love that character that she, mm-hmm. plays so much in that. And so when I read this script, I was like, oh, it kind of... It's, you think it's that character, and then we kind of get to play with that a little bit. So I knew it'd be the kind of thing where the audience will bring in an expectation of, oh, good, it's going to be Anna doing her thing, and then going like, oh my God, there's so much more here. And with Blake, it was the total opposite. It's like Blake, you're used to seeing her as a heroine and a good guy,
right.
And you go like, this is gonna be fun because people are gonna see Blake in a way they've never seen her before, and she's amazing. I mean, they're both so good in it, and Blake just turns in this performance that nobody's going to expect.
Do you approach this film with a whole different look and style and feel? I mean, I called it elegant earlier, and just from the picking up in the trailer, it seems to be a different palette.
Mm-hmm.
There's just choices were made somewhere along the line to give this a very specific look and feel.
I call it suburban noir.
Okay.
And who shot it is our old friend John Schwartzman.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, who we went to film school with.
Oh,
and
fantastic.
John and I have been trying to work together for ever since film school, because he and Greg Araki were film partners, and Rob Lahani and myself were film partners, but the four of us were like a little, we worked on each other's projects. And and I was just, John was, like a rock star in film
time.
School. Yeah, he shot Phil Juano's short Last Chance Dance, and it was like literally like a Spielberg movie had been made in our class. And we were like, what the hell?
I know.
And then, but then John went on to shoot, almost all Michael Bay's movies, at least the first half of his career, and then Spider-Man and all that stuff. But then it just happened where Bob Yeoman usually shoots my movies, who's fantastic, and I love him. But this movie, because our schedule was kind of going off and stuff, he ended up going on to Mamma Mia 2, and John just happened to be available, and it was just great. We just had the best time, and but he really, he embraced this suburban noir thing that I said, because I like the idea of sort of dark things happening in brightly lit normal spaces,
right?
Sort of the banality of evil, versus like noir, where the shadows and things are lurking. Is like, to me, it's scary. Of like, I can see everything, and something really fucked up is going on. Then that's kind of fun.
That's great.
Yeah, and John, John brought that to it, and nobody moves a camera like John Schwartzman, so it's
fantastic.
Pretty cool.
I can't wait.
It's fun. And then on top of it, my third cast member, if you know a movie called Crazy Rich Asians, Henry Golding, who's the star of that, is the male lead in Simple Favor, and he is my hero.
There are some fortuitous timing for you right there, because people are discovering this guy right now as we record this a couple of weeks in a row, and with huge box office, deservedly so. Yeah. Just a terrific film.
Yeah, it really.
And
is.
Boy, this guy, you got him early.
He's
and
great.
Maybe you got him cheap. I don't know.
Well, you know,
compared to now, it might be going up now.
Yeah, I think his price is going to go up. I mean, he is the greatest.
Just a great look, man. Just commands the screen.
Yeah, I just knew I wanted somebody new for this role, and I needed a very specific type of guy who, when you first meet him, you know, you're like, who? It was like, you know, when you meet Blake and his characters, you go like, I just met like Nick and Nora Charles. Like, you know, here's Anna Kendrick, this suburban mom, and suddenly these two beautiful creatures live in her neighborhood. And they're so cool, and they're drinking in the middle of the day, and you know. But then you have to discover a vulnerability in him, and,
right?
You know, and he has to go through a lot of phases, and Henry just seemed perfect, and so you know, I had to work to get him approved, just because people didn't know who he was, and nobody knew if that movie was going to do well. But I was like, you guys, this guy is great. And he went through a lot of hoops. He had to audition a few times, and then he came in and had to do a screen test with Blake Lively, you know, that's got to be nerve-wracking. And, you know, he just killed it. He crushed it. And, and he was so good. You know, but I had called John Chu, who directed Crazy Rich Asians, when I was interested in him, and said, like, is he for real? Because, you know, John's movie was his first acting job. He discovered me. He was a travel show host.
Wow.
Yeah, and I watched his travel show reel from Asia, you know, that he did in, like, Singapore and all that. And he was so charming and funny on it that's all I don't even like. I don't kind of even really audition people that much anymore. I get more from if I can, like, watch something they did, or I can sit and have a drink with them and just see what's funny about them, because then I can tailor something to get their personality. I'm personality. I'm less interested in general with people like acting, you know what I mean? Like creating a crazy character, unless there's somebody you know, like Blake and Anna.
Right.
But
people don't audition well. I mean, I think that's become, now you've been around it enough that I think being in the room and just kind of seeing, maybe testing somebody for chemistry or even improvising something can help, but usually, and also part of it must be just from a personality standpoint, is this somebody I want to spend the next however many weeks with?
That's a huge deal.
I mean, maybe more so than ever.
Totally.
You know, it's one thing to put up with an asshole who's talented, but to put up with an asshole who may not be as talented as...
Yeah.
It's like you'd much rather work with somebody you feel like you've got some potential with, who you actually want to be around for a while.
It's so part and parcel with all that. You know, and again, like you hear somebody's a nightmare, but you go, they're perfect, and I could just kind of get through. But I mean, I'm at a point now where I don't even know if I care about that, because I just don't want to have a bad time.
Yeah.
You know, it's so hard.
People love your sets. I mean,
I run a fun set.
That comes back all the time.
Yeah. You know, I can't work any other way. I can't, if there's tension around or angst, I fall apart, or not even fall apart. I internalize it, and so
it spends
all my energy. Yeah.
You're an actor. You've probably seen situations. You know there are people. You know there are bosses who kind of rule by that you know, fear factor of at any moment they might, and they literally revel in that. And some people are very effective that way.
Yeah, I just don't buy into it, because, and I it seems to work for guys, but I just think, A, why do you want to create a terrible situation for everybody else? And B, I don't think you get the best work out of people. I think the people that run those kind of sets might even get 20% better work and movie and creativity out of the people that they're screaming at, if they weren't screaming at them, because then everybody wants to contribute.
Yeah.
And then you're just the ringmaster. And you look, as a director, you get credit for you get credit for it. So if if the catering guy comes up to me and says, like, hey, I had a funny idea, it's like, cool, tell me. You know, sometimes it's terrible. Sometimes you're like, that's brilliant. Or sometimes you go like, well, not that, but actually, thanks, because that gave me an idea that's kind of like that, but it's tangential to it. And, you know, and they feel good. They've contributed, and I feel great. I got an idea I never would have thought of. You know, and why would you ever cut off the creativity of all these creative people? Whoever's there is there because they've got talent.
Yeah.
So use it.
It only makes sense that you would want people who look forward to coming to work every day.
Yeah.
I mean, I know it's a movie and everything, and people are paid well and all that stuff, but it's still hard work. And you still want to kind of enjoy it at the end of the day.
Yeah, I mean, the pressure is, you know, not poor us in showbiz, but there, you know, there's a lot of pressure because, you know, I'm in charge of millions of dollars, you know, and I'm on a schedule that's super tight, and, you know, I can't go over, and I can't, you know, unless I don't want to work again, you know, and so So you have to almost fake yourself into thinking the stakes aren't high and you're just there kind of having a good time, but at the same time, not so much that you're not realizing that what we're putting down, that's it. Like, that's going to exist forever. And so let's get something good. But then adding on to that, you want to make sure that there's a playfulness about what you're doing, because then you're just capturing lightning in a bottle.
Yeah.
You know
yeah.
what I mean? And if everything's so buttoned up and so rehearsed within an inch of its life, I personally feel like it loses some fun.
Absolutely.
That's why I don't even do camera rehearsals. I kind of go like, okay, they're going to be here. Let's just light it, set it up, and then...
Oh, you don't
happens.
Even do camera. You don't. I mean,
no,
just,
not beyond kind of like
just
okay,
basic
where
blocking.
Do you think you would do? Yeah, like if I do rehearsals, like all right, nobody act, just kind of have
yeah.
this good, and just kind of feel where you would go, and then we can because you know I've had you know in the past when people had to do camera rehearsals, like the first rehearsal, it's like magic.
Yeah, yeah.
And nobody
first
rolled
take
on
out
it.
Of the gate, and nobody's
totally.
Got it.
And
yeah.
you're like, oh, can you do that thing that you did? And like, I don't know what I did. It's like, God damn it, it's gone.
And you can't even play it back.
Because, no, yeah. and I try to act it out, and it's terrible. And then you know, so no, you got to be there.
Let's give a shout out to casting directors real quick because
yes.
they still continue to probably be one of the most underestimated aspects
yep.
of any movie, and I don't know that I've seen who cast this film.
Allison Jones.
Okay, I was going to say, Allison Jones has been connected to you a number of times.
Yeah.
And by the way, it would be impossible to list off all the things that she's been associated with. Every movie that you've seen in the last 20 years that's funny.
And TV show.
And TV show.
Yeah.
The Office.
She cast The Office.
Good, original
Development.
Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Yeah.
She's been a part of.
Yeah, she's the mother of modern comedy. I mean, she just has an eye for
That's
talent.
A big statement right there, but it's absolutely dead on, right?
It's dead true. She yeah. is. There's nobody like her, you know,
yeah.
and she... Boy, she puts her heart and soul into it. She goes out. She finds people that you would never know. She scours the internet for them. She just looks under every rock.
Yeah, she's haunting UCB theater at weird times watching.
Totally.
Yeah.
And then she's got really talented people working for her who
right.
are doing the same thing. And, you know, but what's so fun is she goes like, oh, my God, I found somebody. You got to see them. You know, sometimes you go like, I found a real weirdo or I found a real, you know. And then the person, and you go like, oh, my God, this person's so funny and great. And they got such a fun personality. And, you know, and then you just fall in love with them. And,
right.
No, she is the best.
I'm so glad it was Allison. I was hoping that it was her on this film as well.
Yeah.
A Simple Favor.
Yeah.
In theaters, fill in the blank here.
Yes.
This Friday. Let's say this Friday, Paul, because that's probably when I'll put this up.
Yeah, there you go. Sure,
all
why
right.
not?
You have no filter whatsoever in making
no.
a fool of yourself. We
no.
talked about social media earlier and the goofy man in the nice suit, as I kind of consolidate all the things we've talked about. You had absolutely no problem making a complete fool of yourself on the Joel McHale show with Joel McHale.
No.
I don't know
I
if you were
back.
Were you pressed into duty or were you like, eh, let me do that?
Yeah, I
you had a blast there.
I had so much fun. I mean, yeah. The Soup was one of my favorite shows of all time.
And yeah, is that your involvement? Is that you? How did you get?
My wife and I have been super fans of The Soup back when it was Talk Soup.
Super fans?
So, oh, see,
soup
I did not go
fans?
There. I did not go there. Oh, boy.
I
get
know.
Out.
So tired.
But no, we used to watch it all day back when Greg Kinnear was the host.
Sure.
And it was just always my favorite thing. And they'd always have guests on, you know, somebody celebrity or semi-celebrity would come on. And for years, we'd watch, especially Joel McHale. We really love when Joel hosted it the best.
Yeah.
And I always go like, oh, I wish I could be on there. And then there's some guy I kept meeting at a party who said he was a producer on the show. And he said, like, oh, I'll get you on. And then, like, I never heard anything. And then it turned out he might not have really been a producer on it. And
what, that happens in Hollywood?
Yeah, it's weird. Wasn't that? But so then, like, I finally was, like, called my publicist, like, a few years ago and, like, see if they would ever have me on. It turns out like they actually like what I do, and so they were like, we'd love to have him on. Why, we wish you would have called earlier. I was like, oh no, why didn't I call earlier? So I got to be a guest on The Soup, I think three times, I think. And then it got canceled. And as I was so bummed out, A, because I just missed watching the show, but I also had so much fun on it. So it just made it my goal to get it back on. And I ran into KP Anderson, who's the exec producer on the show. He lives in my neighborhood one day. And I said, like, we got to bring that back. He goes, well, weirdly, Joel's actually talking about maybe doing it. And so we pitched it to Netflix, and they did it. And sadly, they just dropped the show. But
oh, they did?
Yeah, they did. I'm so...
Oh, man.
Distraught, because I think it's so funny, and that we had the greatest team of people on that show, and Joel's so good. Great. Yeah, so if anybody wants to pick it up, it's available.
Now, the team is still available for
you. They are, and it's an amazing team.
You guys, I mean, you basically just need a green screen and a small room,
yes,
and you're good to go.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's literally
The overhead is very low.
Paul
is cheap.
Yes. Yeah, I'm dead cheap. But it'll be on Netflix forever, so you can watch the 18 episodes or... I think we did 18 or 19, so they're still there.
Oh, man. Yeah. Well, I'm hoping somebody's done a supercut. I challenge anybody on the internets to put together a Paul Feig supercut on the Joel McHale with Joel McHale.
I did some really stupid stuff.
You really did.
They would take great joy in seeing how far they could push me.
Man.
And I don't think I ever turned anything down.
So what else, before we wrap up here, what else should we know about A Simple Favor that we haven't covered? Because I want to make sure people check this out.
It's just a really fun movie. It's a real thriller, but you're going to have a really fun time. It's kind of everything you want out of a movie. It's fun to look at. The clothes are beautiful. The cast is beautiful. You'll laugh. You'll scream. You'll be thrilled. You may cry at one point, but you will have a full fun experience. I mean, and honestly, I really do think this is like my favorite movie I've made, just because it checks so many boxes of things that I wanted to do. There you go.
Fantastic. All right, lightning round questions before we wrap up.
I'll see if
I can try and bring you different ones than we did last time.
Okay.
As far as A Simple Favor goes, what is the thriller genre film that would be the touchstone that you kind of turn to for the greatest inspiration in this case?
No Hitchcock in particular, but generally Hitchcock, sort of North by Northwest-y, even though we're not as action-packed as that.
Okay, perfect. If you were forced at gunpoint to go up on a karaoke stage, what would be the go-to song?
Viva Las Vegas.
Okay, I did ask you that last night. What would be your second song
if
that was unavailable?
Oh, man. The Johnny Cash one. I hear that train coming around the bend. And they're going to... it's Folsom Prison Blues.
There it is.
Folsom Prison Blues. Folsom Prison Blues. I can't even say the words. Somehow I'm going to sing it.
Actually, a little kind of similarity in vocal styles between Elvis. Is it just because... I
got a
local
voice. Yeah, exactly. I can't do a Frankie Valli song.
Play to your strengths. Is there a pair of jeans in your closet, and when's the last time you've worn them?
Last night.
Yes.
When I'm sitting around the house at night, I'll just pull on. I have like this one flannel shirt and this pair of jeans that it's my uniform at night.
Okay. Do you iron your jeans?
No.
Thank you.
That would be horrible.
Follow-up to last time's podcast. By the way, go back, everybody, in the Snark Monkey archives and check out the Ghostbusters episode with Paul Feig, which was quite delightful. We really get into the weeds about film school. If you want to hear stories about people and time.
You're a fan of mid-80s or early 80s USC film school, the bungalows. Check it out.
Besides Blues Brothers, name one other 80s movies that you are mildly obsessed with that you think about a lot.
Wait, that's 70s. No, it wouldn't be that.
I'll just say that one.
Well, Animal House.
Okay.
You know? I just think that's such a funny comedy. Again, it's a terrible movie for women. But as far as the female characters go, but I just think the style of comedy in it is very, very funny.
It is. You're right. There are certain things about it from a modern day perspective that are a little rough, but just for genuine laughs, it still holds up as a comedy better than many movies I can think.
Total Anarchy, and the fact that they, and I know John Landis had to fight to get to have Elmer Bernstein do the score, because the score is a very serious, sober score.
Yes.
And that just makes it 10 times funnier.
I think maybe why you thought of that, if it's anything like me, I was too young to see it when it came out in theaters. I didn't actually get to see Animal House until I was on campus at USC and they played it. Yeah.
Well, I
saw it in the 80s, even though it was...
Oh, there you go. My cousin, took me when I was underage. We were in Canada at our cottage, and we went to a packed theater filled with college students, and that was another religious experience.
Must have been raucous.
Oh, it was just, I've never heard an audience other than Raiders of the Lost Ark, the opening.
See, I have, again, because we're movie nerds, I do have very memorable experiences of Star Wars was one in the Wynwood Cinema in Odessa, Texas, at the end, and people were standing on their feet and cheering. They put a disco ball in the ceiling and kind of to create a starry effect at the
end.
And it was like, chills through my whole little, pubescent body. What else? Seeing Richard Pryor's first concert film, the one where he's in the red shirt, the very first
Richard Pryor
live at a midnight showing.
Amazing.
With a whole bunch of white kids in West Texas and literally rolling on the floor laughing so hard I couldn't breathe.
Oh, yeah.
And the entire theater filled just responding to this guy. I've never forgotten that.
Those are religious experiences.
I asked you, this is the follow-up to the question that I must ask. I'm contractually obligated by my overlords to ask a monkey question. Since our last podcast, have you worked with a monkey, had an encounter with a monkey, purchased a monkey, smuggled a monkey into the country, any of those?
No, I have not. Oh. But I did work with a monkey before our last podcast.
I think we told that story.
I have no new monkey shines to report.
Okay, you've got some work to do.
I know.
If there are monkeys in London, tell everybody your socials real quick, because you are fun to watch
in your
travels.
I'm just at Paul Feig, PaulFeig at Twitter and on Instagram.
And what'd you get at your favorite coffee shop in New York the other night?
Oh.
Or day?
Oh! It depends. I mean, it's usually breakfast I have there.
Yeah.
So I believe I had a good Western omelet, egg white omelet.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay.
Nothing better than like a New York omelet.
Paul, you're a mensch, as the folks say.
Back at you.
I hope
back
I'm
at
using
you, Larry.
It right.
You
and a simple favor. I cannot wait.
Yay.
And I hope it does great for you, but not so great that you get too big to continue to talk to me in the future.
No, I'll talk to you. The bigger it gets, the more I'll talk to you.
What?
So let's hope for $1 billion.
Everybody go out. Screw that movie pass. Pay full price.
Yes.
Let's go.
Let's do it.
Get a monkey. Get a monkey!
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.